everybody. This is Trevin McGee from Scene Stealers, and this is a very, very special podcast for all of us because our good friend and contributor from Seattle, Mr. Warren Cantrell, is here.
Hey. Woo! Wake up, Kansas. I'm here.
He's here. All right. Well, also with me today is Eric Moline, who can't say hello because I've bound and gagged him, and Trey Hawk.
Hey, how's it going?
All right. Well, we I'm not going to answer that. It's no one's business. I don't know how it's going.
It's hanging low to the left.
That's hey, what? We're really happy to have Warren here.
Yeah. Happy to be here.
We really are.
High end production.
Yeah. Yeah. So we're here to talk about movies. Actually, but before we do that, we're going to talk first about just real quick the Oscar party. It hasn't happened as of this recording. Probably by the time you listen to this, it will have happened. But yeah, if you get the chance, you should go. And we're really looking forward to having you. It's at the Terrace on Grand. And I don't know, anything we need to add
Sunday
to that?
The 20th.
I was going to say, if you got any money, bring it, because we're rowdy.
It could be rowdy. It's definitely going to be kind of a swanky affair, I think. But you don't have to dress up. We're talking about Sunday night, 6 o'clock, Kansas City, 18th and Grand. The event space is Terrace on Grand. Big $5 if you want to do the ballot and play along. If you don't, we're going to have food. We're going to have drinks. We're going to have drinking games. And most importantly, someone's going to go home with a lot of money, and everybody else is going to go home with a lot of movie swag.
Yeah, and the losers get some very special movie swag. And it's swag. I checked it. It's swag. It's not swag.
And it is just swag?
It's swag.
Sure? Did you check Webster?
Yes.
Yeah.
What did he say?
He said it was swag.
He's full of shit.
Okay. All
right. Well,
here's the thing. If you have to check like Webster mm-hmm. for your awesome hip nomenclature,
yeah.
That's not the way I want to say it. Anyway.
Most people don't. You guys do. Yeah. Most people don't.
Like, don't say swag?
Yeah. No, most people don't say swag unless they're talking about
like, I say swag.
Bad weed. Yeah, but that's not the right swag is the promotional nonsense.
We're not talking
swag
about smoking drugs here.
So what we're going to talk about today is we're going to talk about the new movie Act of Valor. We're going to talk about the new movie Wanderlust, and then we're going to move quickly on because Warren's here to do a special thing where we each talk about a movie that we hate and we don't understand why everybody else loves it.
Being in town and from Seattle, we decided we must talk about something hateful.
Yes.
It's sort of my specialty. So indulge me, Kansas.
All right, well, before we get there, let's first talk about Act of Valor. Which
Speaking
was,
of hate.
Yeah, which was the movie that I reviewed this week. And, yeah, if you haven't seen it yet, if you're not familiar with the big premise, or gimmick, rather, and I think calling it a gimmick is very accurate because it is cheap. And
don't you support our troops?
Yeah, I do. That's why I don't. That's why I don't like this exploitative, insulting, shitty movie. Act of Valor's big play is that all of the main actors are active duty Navy SEALs, and they use real life tactics and real life weaponry, and the combat scenarios are also based on real life.
Wait, I'm a little confused. I thought Hollywood was the province of genuine things and real life scenarios.
No? Yeah, for the most part.
No?
Yeah.
Oh. Oh, no, okay. I was confused.
No,
sorry,
no,
go
no.
on, please.
Yeah, yeah.
Continue.
So there's not really much to say about this other than it's just, it's not a good movie in any way. And obviously you're dealing with some actors that aren't actually actors, and that shows right away. But, you know, I can give that a pass. Normally, you know, it's okay because that's what they're trying to go for. If they're trying to go for some sort of heightened realism.
But this is a specific marketing ploy as well.
Oh,
you
yeah.
should mention
totally.
That.
It absolutely is. And it didn't happen at the screening that I went to, but a friend and contributor to Dad's Big Plan, Alan Rapp, saw it. And when he saw it, there was like a 10-minute mini-doc before the movie with the co-directors talking about how great it was to work with these
that
guys.
Wasn't
and
on
how
the screening you saw?
No.
Weird.
Yeah.
He said that there was an interview with the two directors,
mm-hmm.
and they were talking about why they used people, and they were directly addressing the audience before the movie started. As if to
like get them hooked and get them in.
Or as if to explain themselves.
Right.
Yeah, of
You're
course.
About to see a movie with bad acting.
I mean,
why?
Right. We knew why. Hey, we knew that we know it's awful. But there's a reason why. And if you don't like that, you're not American.
But that explanation doesn't even make sense, because Best Years of Our Lives has a non-actor. The dude won...
Two Oscars.
He won two Oscars for the same role because they didn't think... They thought, it's nice that he got nominated for Best Actor, but he won't win.
Right.
So we'll give him an honorary actor as a...
And then he
won both.
Hold on. If you're gonna take it to Best Years of Our Lives, you're already like... two or three levels above where this movie is.
No, I understand. But just copping out, like using it as your marketing campaign to say, hey, these are non-actors.
Yeah, no.
So that then we'll forgive their bad acting doesn't even make sense.
George Lucas did that earlier in the year by saying that people don't want black movies. He did. And then he said, here's Red Tails.
I love how you kind of turned George Lucas into Kanye West.
Yes.
Yeah.
People don't like black. George Bush doesn't like black movies.
Right.
But the thing is, nobody wanted his black movie because it was a shitty movie.
Yeah.
Not because it was a black movie.
Yeah.
Well, that's the same thing here. It's not a black movie, but it's a shitty movie. Act of Valor. So let me get back to what I was trying to say. Its initial premise, just the idea of using fake or real live people, active duty officers, like, I'll forgive that, you know, if it adds a heightened sense of realism, but it doesn't, because the minute it gets into the action movie territory, the very first action scene is very tactics based, and you get to see some of their method, and that works for a little bit, but then they immediately abandon that and turn it into a kind of they use first person, and it makes it look like a video game, and they never use first person anywhere else but only during the action sequences. But they'll duck into first person, you'll see these takedowns, you'll see these kills, and I heard it audibly when I was leaving the theater, multiple people say, it was just like Call of Duty, it was just like Battlefield. And, you know, for this movie that's also supposed to be a tribute or supposed to honor these men and women that have laid down their lives, I don't really think trying to compare yourself to a video game that sort of trivializes war and trivializes how substantial the loss of every human life is, I don't understand how you can say that you're doing that when you're trying to draw direct comparisons to a popular video game.
Further, is that even really necessary? I think that multiple movies have demonstrated that you don't necessarily need active operators, people who are in the military, acting in your movie to make or lend it some level of credence or genuineness. I think that any number of movies go out there who have advisors who are Navy SEALs, who have advisors who are former Army Rangers, things like that, who can help choreograph an action scene without acting in it and still get the same results across.
Yeah, I mean, Dale Dye's made an entire career off doing that. So forgive the story, move on to the action. The action's a failure. Okay, well then, is its heart in the right place? Is it really trying to highlight the sacrifices and the needs of these men and women? No, it really doesn't. It doesn't even go that far. You have a plot that's very basic, that feels like it's from a season of 24. It's literally girl gets captured, girl has information, SEALs save her, there's a bomb, let's go get the bomb, the end. And that they try and tie some emotional stuff through there, but partially because the acting isn't great, but more because the writing is just garbage. The writing's really uninspired, doesn't really hit anywhere, doesn't really make anybody feel anything. You're left with a big emotional void there, too. So it just, on the three levels that I felt like you could look at this movie, I felt like it failed in all three
so,
ways.
But here's the other thing. All right, so the acting is the storyline,
the action.
But does it work as a recruitment tool? Like, would people walk out of this and go, because that's that, honestly, when I heard about this movie coming, I thought, man, they're trying to, because after Navy SEALs came out, after Top Gun came out, there were all of these little mini spikes in recruitment. Now, the difference is Top Gun's still kind of like cheap fun. I mean, there's some real, there's some fun to that. I mean, you've got Loggins. So,
yeah.
I mean, you're always win with Loggins.
Loggins is always a hit.
But does this work as an effective recruitment tool? Because, I mean, all right, so if nothing else works, then does the bottom line work? Does the recruitment tool work?
Kind of.
Maybe.
A little bit.
I mean, about camaraderie, isn't it?
There's more camaraderie. I mean, there is sort of a dramatic. There's one character that's very much a sacrificing hero. There's another character that, you know,
is it played by Mel Gibson?
Right. No, he doesn't get tortured at any point.
He's not a martyr.
No. Okay. So, but there is a character that it's written on the wall really early that this guy's probably not going to make it out of there. And of course, he doesn't.
So he's black.
No, he's not. Anyway, he doesn't. He's not going to make it. But we know he's not. And he's not wearing a red shirt. No. So there's that character that kind of sort of fulfills that sacrifice duty type role. There's another character who gets the mission done no matter what. And then there's this one guy that they just kind of cut to, and he's badass, and like nothing ever happens to him. They don't flesh his character out, but he's just really good at being a soldier and gets a lot of kills and does a lot of stuff.
I think this sort of presents the paradox of this whole scenario, which is that on the one hand you have a recruitment tool, and on the other hand you have a movie striving to be the model of authenticity. And there really is no middle ground between that, because if you're looking to sort of flesh back the horrors of war and the realities of war, it's that, you know, people die. It might not be for very, very good reason. And, you know, in a lot of cases, this is not necessarily an uplifting story. However, on the other hand of this, you have a recruitment tool that you're trying to get people into the armed services. So, I mean, there is no middle ground here. You're either trying to get people in or you're trying to scare them the hell away.
And see, that's the thing. It's like, I don't really feel like. Does it work as a recruitment movie? No. I don't think it's a recruitment movie.
But the same thing is that there were actual spikes. Whenever you've got, like, some focus movie, you know, with a named actor that's playing some sort of military hero, there are always little mini spikes after that. So if they had just gone for it and made a movie instead of trying to make a movie that works as a recruitment tool.
Battle Los Angeles.
But see,
exactly. But I wanted to join the military just to fight Los Angeles.
You guys have talked about the recruitment part, and I didn't see it as a recruitment movie. I don't think anyone's going to walk out of there and saying, like, let's go ahead and join. I'm going to quit talking, though, because apparently it's way more entertaining to just tear down anything close to a complete thought that I'm having. So,
well, I think Eric and I were both the students to interrupting land, and you were the master, and now we have learned well. You guys are really good.
That's true. Yeah.
Here, let's let
Warren
get
it. I'm getting a taste of my own medicine. You're right.
All right.
Anyway, so to just really wrap everything up with Act of Valor, it's not a very good movie at all, and it just kind of fails in every way that you could view it. You know, admittedly, I'm not in the armed forces. I know it's a sensitive topic. I know a lot of families are affected by it. But as a movie, it doesn't work. As a recruitment tool, it doesn't work. As sort of a tribute to the armed forces, it doesn't work. And as a big, dumb action movie, it just doesn't work. So
after this, Trevin is going to the airport to call people baby killer.
Yeah. Right. It does not work as a teen drama. It does not work as a romantic comedy.
It is the best rom-com of the year.
Yeah. So let's move on now. Then let's talk to Eric about Wanderlust, and then maybe I can chime in during that the whole time.
I'm going to try really hard to make this short, because honestly, here's the deal: Wanderlust is a very simple film.
Okay.
So there's really not a lot of
simple film with simple goals.
It's a simple film.
You know it is. Yes, it is. Okay. So here's the bottom line: you get your David Wayne. Right, he's the director.
Yeah,
this is the guy who did Wet Hot
American Summer.
Literally,
dozens of people are excited now that you've mentioned
about after David Wayne. Yeah, actually, David Wayne did a really great movie a couple years ago that I think kind of flew under the radar, called Role Models, which was really funny with Paul Rudd,
fucking hilarious.
Yeah, and Sean William Scott and Christopher Mintz Plasse from Superbad. And the thing about Role Models that made it so good is that the characters were absolutely genuine. They may not have been the brightest bulbs in the closet.
They
were
also humongous Kiss fans,
by
the way.
You said brightest bulbs in the closet.
Did I? Yeah.
Yeah.
In the closet?
What?
It means that they're
like
they're
a utility
really
closet full of light bulbs. Is that what you're talking
about? Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. So.
Gay bulbs.
Yeah. So no, but here's okay. So what I'm trying to say, David Wayne, as you may or may not know, is one of the members of MTV's The State comedy sketch troupe.
Yeah, dip your balls in it.
Yeah, I want to dip my balls in it. This movie was co-written by Ken Marino, who is the I Want to Dip Your Balls in It guy.
Yeah.
Everybody in The State, minus one person, is in this movie, okay?
Really? So, I didn't know that.
Yeah, they're all in it. Not true. Thomas Lennon. Yep. So, Michael Ian Black is in it there. Everybody has a cameo.
Is Bradley Cooper in it?
Bradley Cooper is not in it.
Okay, then I don't care.
Okay. Let's just ask me who else is in it, and we'll just do that for 5 minutes.
Is Paul Rudd in it?
Yes, he is.
Is Jennifer Aniston in it?
She is. Yeah. Paul Giamatti?
Is Key from Key and Peele? Is Key from Key and Peele
yes,
in it?
Yes, he is.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mira Sorvino.
Wait.
Not in it.
Oh, yeah. Not?
What? This is great. Let's keep going. So, Wanderlust, basically, you got the basic setup is that Paul
Meryl
Rudd...
Streep. Is Meryl Streep in it?
In it. Paul Rudd and Jennifer Aniston are a couple in New York, and the bottom line is that she is unfocused, doesn't know what she wants to do with her life. He is working shitty jobs to make sure that they're happy, and they just bought a new apartment that they can't afford, and the very day that they buy it, he gets laid off. And her HBO documentary about penguins with testicular cancer is turned down. Yeah. So immediately you're dealing with two things. You're dealing with on a real level. There is a certain thing going on in the country right now where people are having a hard time struggling to find their place in the world economically. On the other side is this absurd level of comedy where Jennifer Aniston is actually producing a documentary about penguins with testicular cancer, and we're meant to believe that her character thinks this is a good idea, okay? So we have two opposing forces. We have absurdity and a character drama trying to work.
We have absurdity.
And here's what happens is eventually the absurdity just wins out, and this movie is funny.
Yeah.
Okay. They're trying to fit it into the formula that most Adam Sandler comedies fit into, which is a character does a bunch of dumb things for most of the film, has a big realization, and then all of a sudden everything works out at the end and it's happy. And that's what happens in this film as well.
In this film, Adam Sandler is played by Paul Rudd.
Exactly. But here's the thing. Paul Rudd is funnier than Adam Sandler.
Jim Carrey, normally played by Adam Sandler, will now be played by Paul Rudd. Yeah.
And on a basic level, Paul Rudd has something that those guys don't have, which is the ability to improv in character on one thing and just go for broke. Okay, and so what happens is they end up in a hippie commune. Mm-hmm. Justin Thoreau is the hippie guy, the Charles Manson or whatever. Except there's no murders. This isn't Martha May, Mary, Marlene, whatever the fuck.
You always get that wrong.
I can't do it. I can't do it unless I'm reading it. Say it. So it basically becomes a general hippie communal living comedy where you've got a nudist walking around and people wanting to do free love, and the urbanites don't agree with that, and they're having a hard time adjusting, okay? What makes it funny is that Paul Rudd, against every bone in his body, against everything that makes him who he is, tries really hard to do this. And it's not funny if he's just making fun of everybody the whole time. What's funny is that he really tries to make this work, and it all blows up in his face. Yeah. Aniston is her usual, boring, straightforward self. I don't see why she keeps getting work in films, because she adds little or nothing to them.
They all make a certain amount of money.
Yeah.
That's
why. And even in Horrible Bosses,
she's our new Julia Roberts.
Well,
no.
I think Julia Roberts has more charm.
Maybe.
Yeah.
I don't know.
She's definitely got a bigger fucking mouth. I'll give you that.
So bottom line, Wanderlust, when it goes off the rails, and it does quite a bit, and it gives Paul Rudd and some of these really gifted comedic actors the chance to show off a little bit, it works. And it's really funny. And there was one scene in particular where Paul Rudd is in front of the mirror trying to gear up for a sexual act. And he does this for way longer than the take should have been. It was almost like they left the outtake reel in, and the audience was laughing so hard, including me. I was crying.
Wow.
I do not cry from laughter in movies very often. So, yes, it's uneven.
The last time you cried was War Horse, if I remember right.
So when they let the narrative go, that's when it works.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, because we all know, from the moment the movie starts exactly how it's going to end. And it does. And that's fine, because along the way, the absurd kind of lunatic humor just kind of takes over, and that stuff is really funny. The other standout performance in this movie is Michaela Watkins, who was formerly on Saturday Night Live, and I don't know if she quit or got kicked off, but she was the Hoda Kotb to
Kotb. You're already doing the name thing. It's Hoda Kotb.
Okay, Hoda Kotb. To Kathy Lee Gifford, played by Kristen Wiig. And mm-hmm. she was really funny in that, but she's really good in this and very dry.
I know who you're talking about. Lorne Michaels just kind of fired her.
Yeah.
Said that she was meant for bigger things.
Well, that makes sense because if she's funny, she's naturally going to be kicked off of Saturday Night Fucking Live. So.
So she does. She really does a great job on this film, and it's a really edgy performance too. Like the things that she's saying, there is some pretty fucked up shit.
Yeah.
In this movie, is a definitely a rated R movie, and it's not just a feel good kind of thing either. Like sometimes it does get into some actual issues. But mostly I think this is proof positive that Paul Rudd can carry a movie and be very, very funny. It's not perfect.
Yeah.
It's just funny.
But your assessment of it makes me really excited to go and see it because it's like just legitimate screwball comedy. It's like, hey, let's just tie together a loose story. And I think that Hollywood has been really scared to do those. They want to give you that treacly narrative so they can kind of like split the fence,
there.
You know?
That's there.
And that's fine. But if they let it go off the rails.
Yeah.
If they let it go,
they lose control of it just
exactly.
Enough.
Yeah. Then it can be like, I mean, you just accept that this is absurd and it's just done for a laugh and it's funny.
Again, this is a minor rock fist up. I'm not going crazy over this film because in the end, it's just not put together in the way that something like Knocked Up is or Bridesmaids is. But it's very funny.
Yeah,
and I'm just gonna say that it was very refreshing. So. Now, on that subject, we're going to move into our next thing, which is what's the movie that you hate that everybody else likes?
Yeah, everyone has that. Everyone has a movie that like all your friends love and quote, and you're just kind of stuck on the outside. You're the odd man out.
And I mentioned Wet Hot American Summer earlier.
Well, you alluded to it, yeah.
Yes. Don't hate it, just don't like it.
Yeah.
Okay? That's how we're going to go into this, but that's not the movie I'm picking. The movie I'm picking is... The Big Lebowski.
Ooh.
Oh, fuck me. Come on, man. You said it. Now defend yourself.
I mean, that kind of was a low blow to start this all off.
No shit.
Hey, I wanted to start it off right. Yeah. I am the biggest Coen Brothers fan probably in this room. Okay? Fargo is my third favorite film of all time. I think Fargo is one of the greatest films ever made. I think it balances that satirical comedy and intense... drama with a really dark sense of humor better than anything they've ever done. The movie that followed that was The Big Lebowski. In that way, there is no way for me to express how disappointed I was when I saw this film. The Big Lebowski, to me, is... and everybody said, oh, it's The Big Sleep. I love The Big Sleep with Humphrey Bogart, right? I mean, this is a crazy Chandler off-the-rails type movie. The Big Lebowski tries harder than any... movie and the Coen Brothers canon and succeeds less than any of them do. It's a series of unfunny sketches with people going beyond parody and not succeeding, and then they just move on right to the next thing.
You know,
I
think that's a fair assessment from someone on the outside looking in. I would actually flip that on its ear and say that this is a movie that's trying desperately hard not to try, and that people who feel that way, I feel anyway, that is an audience member trying to understand the humor of this movie, which admittedly is a bit niche. It is a bit narrow as far as the scope of the audience that it's going after, and that in that way, I think that it is a movie where audience members, not the movie in particular, is trying hard.
You can't tell me that all that shit with Julianne Moore was not trying way too hard. I mean, she's just like, oh, look how weird I am. Oh, and look at this weird guy. And oh, he's in a German krautrock band. And oh, look at these weirdo nihilists. And oh, here's John Goodman. And all he does is scream for the entire film.
Does the female form make you nervous, Mr. Lebowski? Does the word vagina make you uncomfortable?
I think you've just proved my point.
No,
I think this movie tries too hard.
I mean,
that's not a funny line.
This aspect was a part of what they do from the get-go. I mean, all you have to do is watch Barton Fink, and Barton Fink is a heady, heady movie.
But Barton Fink doesn't show its it doesn't throw it out there and beg for you to think that it's funny. It's funny if you let it be funny.
I think Lebowski
is mugging.
But
I don't think Lebowski is trying to do any. That's the thing about that movie. I don't think that movie has any ambitions to do anything. I think that Lebowski is just as laid back and uninspired and bored as its protagonist. That's what I think.
You just called the movie uninspired and boring.
Yeah.
Okay.
I still think it's funny. I still think it's funny.
I don't think it's their shining moment.
No.
But I don't think it's a despicable film either.
No. And again, I'm not saying it's despicable. Sure. And in fact, I think the best thing about it is Jeff Bridges.
Yeah.
I think the character of the dude is a classic movie character, and I love that character. I just feel like everything surrounding...
You just hate the movie that he's in.
Yeah, everything surrounding that character seems like they're trying too hard.
See, and I think
a ferret in a bathtub?
With Flea and Amy Mann?
What's up with that? And Peter Stormare?
I think the trying too hard applies... Maybe the trying too hard applies to that era of Coen Brothers films.
Yeah. That's the one right after the best movie they ever made, Trey.
First of all, Fargo's not the best movie they ever made.
Miller's Crossing is incredible.
Miller's Crossing is their best movie.
I don't know. Miller's Crossing, I think I've got to agree with Eric because there is that element of humor that plays so well and furthers the drama in Fargo. I would say that Big Lebowski and then what was the one that they did with Tom Hanks?
Lady Killers.
That was not good.
No.
Was that the next one? After
No, because they did Intolerable Cruelty. Well, didn't they do Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? And then Intolerable Cruelty and then Lady Killers?
Those three or four movies in there, I think, was a tired time for them.
Yeah.
And they didn't really get it back until... They didn't get really get it back until No Country.
I would agree
with you that they were taking a nap. They were taking a little break.
The Big Lebowski for me is just what we define this little segment to be, which is I think it's a lesser thing. I don't think it's that funny, and it has become something that is enormous. So
to move from that and to speak about something I have nothing but unequivocal hate for, and
everyone
here has been very polite about the Big Lebowski, and that's okay.
It's the Midwest. We're just polite.
Yeah. I mean, everyone's
that's
very polite. I was going to mention that too on the plane here. I've never seen so many people asking to assist others in getting things up into the overhead. It was despicable. Anyway, if we're going to talk about something that is just absolute garbage, and I'm talking refuse. Let's talk a little bit about Almost Famous, one of the movies that makes... No, I'm not even kidding. This movie makes me fucking angry. This movie makes me upset about the medium of cinema, about the profession of acting. Pretty much anything that you can throw into filmmaking. I was mad at the guy who held the goddamn boom mic for this movie.
Yeah.
All of them should be run out. I mean, seriously, round them up. We're talking about a movie here that is asking us to... I think two things. One, forget that we all know that rock stars and famous people are assholes who will cut your throat so they can make a little bit extra money or pretty much do whatever that those people do. They shit in toilets filled with Perrier. I mean, it's absolutely ludicrous. I find the idea that we're supposed to associate with a main character who goes on the road with a rock band in the late 70s as a sympathetic character who I'm supposed to go through that journey with that person who throughout the course of the movie learns what? That girls on the road will... fuck your brains out and then leave you sort of standing on the side of the road, and that rock stars ain't what they cracked up to be. I found the forced sentimentality of the movie in conjunction with the message that was already tired and old before the beginning credits rolled offensive, especially from a filmmaker like Cameron Crowe, who I do have respect for, who I think is a very good writer, who I do think has a good cinematic eye, who nevertheless, I think, just really kind of went into his own childhood, recycled some memories, slapped on some fake band names, and asked us to buy it as a part of some sentimental journey into a land we never got to experience. I would have liked to be a fucking kid with Rolling Stone in the 70s hanging out with my heroes, but I'm pretty sure no one else except him and a handful of other people did that. So why am I forced to go to a movie where I'm supposed to associate with some fucking filth who I couldn't give a shit about? There it is.
Do you want the short answer?
Do it.
Because you didn't get to do that, and he did. And here's the thing. This movie addresses, for those of us who have been rock and roll fans since they were kids, the one basic problem of rock and roll. The stars, as you said, never live up to the myth, okay? Yeah. What this movie does is it illustrates that in a way that is approachable. It's not about a drug addict. It's not about somebody who it's not The Doors. It's not a downward spiral story, yeah. right? It's not the Janis Joplin story or whatever. This is a story about a kid who comes to this as a fan of rock and roll. And he gets an early warning from Philip Seymour Hoffman. Yes, Lester Bangs. And those scenes, for somebody like me who's been listening to rock and roll and trying to think intellectually about it for a really long time, those scenes set up the entire rest of the film. Yeah. He tells this kid, he tells William Miller, who's about to go on the road with Stillwater, he says, kid, it's not what you think it's going to be. You got to be true to yourself. And it's really about being... not just about being a journalist, but about being a person who can identify the difference between myth and between reality. And what happens is he goes on the road and he discovers all of this is true. But in the middle of that, he is having his own coming-of-age problem with his mother. And if we don't at least bring up the concept of he and his liberal, forward-thinking mother's relationship, we're missing what half of the movie is about. And Frances McDormand is fantastic in this movie. And the whole idea of a mother letting their son go on the road and doing this and then actually getting the behind the scenes of what she was thinking while that was happening, I think that's another great layer. And for me, I'm just going to finish, tons of layers in this movie. So I don't think it can be reduced to just one thing. All the things you said are certainly parts of it. But for me, and being somebody who's been on the road and done this kind of thing, all these things are philosophical considerations that you have to think about while you're doing this, because it's about being true to yourself, and that's what the whole movie's about.
And I think I think that you even hint at one of the difficulties at critiquing a film in any realm when you're too close to the subject matter. And that you bring a lot to it, and you make up for it. Because ultimately, the scenes...
Hold on, am I making up for it, or am I saying that this validates an experience that I find to be real? Am I making excuses, or am I...
I think you're glossing over a lot of the over-sentimentality of this film.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that the tiny dancer bus scene, my God.
I mean, that's the thing. That's the thing. Is it the Lester Bangs scenes? Awesome. The Frances McDormand scenes, awesome.
Yeah.
Those aren't the backbone of this film.
No,
it is this kid's experiences on the road. Those are subplots to the main plot.
Yeah,
which is a coming of age story that this kid undergoes while in the midst of this.
And Trey Hawk, my tour manager for years on the road, should know better than anybody that when you're on the road and you have crazy experiences, you look back at those with nostalgia and fondness.
Absolutely. But nostalgia by itself, especially when nostalgia is employed, should immediately draw skepticism, because it's adding a level of sentimentality to it that isn't present. I totally understand there are parts of this movie that I can watch and it will immediately bring up a memory of my own that I have had. So I do have a connection to this film. I totally understand what you're saying, but I think it is flawed in the fact that it does lather on, as Cameron Crowe does many times. All you have to do is talk about Jerry Maguire, or what is it, the Somethingville that the elf dude was in? The Hillary Town, or what was his name?
Jesus.
Yeah, Elizabethtown. I mean, he has a tendency to go for the sort of cheap emotional punch, the over-sentimentality, and this film does not avoid that.
I think you guys are bringing up two very good points, which is that... these two gentlemen being in the music industry, I think it rings a lot of bells for someone who's had that sort of experience. As someone who immediately, as I did from high school, went to college, did not get laid, didn't go to parties, had no fun whatsoever, I cannot connect to this movie even an inch. This is a movie about people with lives way better than mine, having more fun than I'll ever have in my life. And, I mean, Jesus Christ, how am I supposed to sit down and not want to reach through this movie and just throttle everyone I see? They can all go to hell. You and your perfect fucking lives can just go take a shit.
But you understand,
I don't want to see it.
William Miller is trying to say this is fraudulent. So that should hold up with what you're saying.
Because by the end of that movie, he comes to re-earn the respect of these rock gods. it has some sort of reconciliation with his sister and mother, and everyone rides off into the sunset at the end. So what is that? Him coming to a realization at the end of the movie, which is what? In the 1970s, everyone's family got together and got along okay, and that rock stars turned out to be flawed but supportive of every individual fan's needs.
Okay, so here's
that's
the deal.
Kind of what I got out of that movie, and I don't see that as a sort of genuine experience.
I will agree with you that I don't think that he earns the respect of the rock stars. I think he earns the respect of one rock star who decides to abandon this way of life. Now, whether that is realistic or not, it's not.
It's not.
Is that goes into the sentimentality that Trey was talking about earlier, and I think that Crow does have that. But yeah. I think in this movie, the personal bond that he and this Russell character had and that his mom had, it was really kind of a weird triangle that it had to end this way. Did it end this way for him and the Allman Brothers? Certainly did not. Did it end this way for him and Led Zeppelin? No, it didn't, right? And he went on to bigger and better things and everything. But I think that the movie had to end that way. Is it realistic? No.
No. Well, I think we should just leave it there because it's...
I agree. I think that there's a lot more discussion to be had about this film, which maybe on a different podcast we may be able to get into further. However,
I do know. I mean,
yeah,
I do definitely yeah, I do definitely sympathize with Warren though, because I was really kind of on the outside. I like the movie. I don't love it, and there are scenes that really just kind of years later now make my toes curl. And the
in a bad way or in a good way?
In a bad way.
I mean, seriously, like you're having sex with this movie?
You curl your toes when you have. I don't want to know that.
Always.
Well, regardless of that,
Trey tenses
tidbit,
up whenever he's being entered.
Wow! Oh, wow! Oh my God! Yeah. Anyway.
All right, okay. Trevin, what's your movie?
Mine. I wanted to hear Trey's because I like talking to Trey.
I mean, I have lists. I have lists of these.
We only have time for one. Pick a doozy, right? I think we just went through some doozies.
Here, I'll let you choose between two. They're
okay.
By the same director. We can either talk about Dark Knight or Inception.
I have no preference.
Talking about why you think Dark Knight is not a good movie is just going to piss me off.
Oh, I mean, I can explain in great detail. Which would you like, Trevin?
I've heard bits of both.
You've
so
heard bits of both.
I've heard you talk to me about. You have talked to me about both of them. I'm too excited for Dark Knight Rises. I don't want you to piss me off about that. So let's talk about Inception.
Okay, so we're taking the easy way out.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right.
We will.
No, that's fine. I mean, you guys are weak and
yep.
That's can't,
right.
cannot back up the movies that you love. I
keep
understand
going.
That.
No, it's fine. You just keep at it. Mm.
You know, Inception is a film that I consistently tell my students, don't just go for something that's cool. Go for something that means something. And if you can
I consistently tell my students... And because I'm a professor, I think that my opinion is...
Class.
No, I mean, that's okay.
I say, students, listen to me. All eyes on me, the front of the class.
I'm also a demented alcoholic.
Inception is terrible.
Excuse me.
What I should tell you about Inception is not good at all.
It out-clevers itself. It consistently goes for the amazing visuals and oftentimes achieves amazing visuals, but sets up this super fragile glass house that then doesn't pay out in the narrative. I mean, the characters are flat. I think Leonardo DiCaprio is one of the most overrated actors of his era.
Agreed.
You know, and so anyway, I just feel that it consistently goes for the punch of trying to do as many amazing visual effects as it can, and it does that, and it achieves them, and it is, you know, but it ultimately, I walked out bored and fundamentally dissatisfied with the story it told. I did not play into the whole, oh, is he still dreaming or was he awake? Did he get out of it? Did he not? Because I fundamentally didn't care.
Yeah.
No, it's
yeah.
like a boxer who throws nothing but haymakers. It just no jabs, no setups, just going for the knockout every single time.
Would you like to say something, Eric?
Yeah, no, I do. I do want to say something. And this is the thing, okay? Yes, it's a puzzle box. Yes, it may be a glass house. Yes, if you think too much about it, you will probably come away with a reason to dislike it based on plot alone, based on the rules it sets up, and maybe some of those rules aren't followed 100%. What I found the second time I watched it, and I know you've seen it more than once too, so I'm not telling you anything new, was that I was able to focus on Leonardo DiCaprio's character. Did he have a lot of time? No. To establish this relationship with his wife, played by Marion Cotillard,
yeah.
and have this tragic story of their life and the choice that she made, and him trying to get back to that or make that right because of his own guilt, maybe that could have been a little bit more. Maybe there could have been more scenes exploring that, and maybe he could have had some more character drama based around that story. I will agree with that. I don't think Inception was one of the greatest movies of that year. It was in my top 10, but it didn't kick my ass. But I think that being there was enough to make it very interesting because it wasn't just a puzzle box. I think that I'd disagree with you, and I would say that every move that his character makes in the movie is based on the stuff that we learn later about he and his wife,
yeah,
and him trying to get back to that. And yes, it's dense and it's hard to get to because you're still thinking about this fictional setup and you're trying to make that right in your mind. But like Shutter Island, which came out shortly after that, both of those movies for me worked really well as films about a central character who's so flawed that you're questioning his logic throughout the entire film, and then when you learn something about his backstory, it makes the film even richer.
But I feel like most of those things are offered almost as bullet point facts of things because they don't have the time. They've got such a detailed amount to explain.
There's a lot of rules.
Exactly. Yeah. That they don't have the time to stick with it. And here, I want to use this as a counterpoint just to kind of make my point that, all right, so Inception is a special effects driven film.
I also reject that.
Yeah.
I do too.
I mean, almost every single frame in that is manipulated.
No, absolutely not. No. There's the scene at the end where the guys are flying through the air because of the gravity and whatnot.
Yeah.
And there's the scene in the middle where Ellen Page is, what do you call that thing that she does? She's creating the world or whatever.
Oh, yeah. And she's rearranging.
There's a term for it. I don't remember. But those two special effects scenes.
I mean, those are big computer, but you're saying that this isn't an effects heavy, even practical?
No,
effects?
I think that's about 15 minutes of a 2+ hour film. Yeah, the hallway. That's 10 minutes, and then 5 minutes at the most.
And while that's a visual effect, it also, there's way more.
Man, I want to fact check
you
that.
Saying it's an effects driven film.
But here's the thing. This is what I'm going to say, is that Scott Pilgrim was a film that was Inception's contemporary. Came out within a few months of Inception. And was largely a box office failure,
yeah.
And was arguably a special effects-driven film, but every single special effects effect that appeared furthered the character of Scott Pilgrim.
Except for the end.
Agreed.
Yeah. I mean, but I'm just saying
right.
that it's not impossible to merge the two. So it's not impossible.
I reject your basic concept that it's an effects-driven movie. So I can't even deal with this argument. Because I'm saying it's an idea-driven film. I really am. Yes, he sets up his own world, but I think that...
I would lowbrow it and say it's a gimmick-driven film. Oof. That he came up with this idea that it's like, hey, we want to go with the dream within a dream within a dream. And that's basically what they do for the entire film. And all he does is he grabs the idea of a heist, you know, a heist
right.
film.
I was
and
just
it's a shitty heist film.
Yeah.
Okay, so here's the deal.
In a heist film... The thing is, the central conceit is who's lying and who's not, and who's going to steal from the next person. Like, who do you trust? How far down the line do you go? And you're right. I'm glad you brought that up.
Yeah.
It's a heist film, except it's in dreams, right? And you run the risk, like Rian Johnson did in The Brothers Bloom, of alienating the audience at a certain point. when you pull that card too many times and the audience feels like you're too clever for your own good,
right.
I am sick of this shit, or I saw this coming a mile away.
Right.
And I think he does a pretty good job of upending the things that we're expecting in Inception.
I mean, maybe. I just felt it was very tired, and I felt it was flat all the way around as far as the acting. I didn't feel engaged in the characters.
Yeah.
You know, part of that could be purposeful, but I think part of it is accidental. I think part of it just comes through. And I think it's too complex for its own good. I think they could have simplified the story and made it much more interesting. And we could be discussing this on multiple different levels as far as ideas of perception or whatever.
I forgot. Did you give Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy a thumbs up or a rock fist up or down?
I didn't review it.
Okay. But if we're talking about complex stories, how do you compare that?
I would be somewhere in the middle on Tinker, Tailor. I wasn't thrilled with it, but I didn't hate it either. I do think that Tinker, Tailor, you and I have had this discussion by ourselves, but I do think Tinker, Tailor doesn't work as an espionage thriller. I think if you're going to compare them on the same thing, as far as complex plots, I think both fail.
Who would win in a fight between Leonardo DiCaprio and Gary Oldman?
Gary Oldman's going to break ankles. Gary Oldman's
Yeah.
I'm so glad you said that. I mean, I was hoping we could be friends, but I know now that we can be.
But you know, I do think that I think that's one of the reasons why Tinker Tailor, you know, has difficulties also, is that in the espionage plot, it has problems.
Yeah.
So.
All right, well, we're going to go to me now.
Okay.
I say it's my turn. I say it's my.
Yeah, and I'm the drunk professor.
Right. The one that always, there are several. Pretty much every Will Ferrell movie I come down on. I feel like the guy who's not invited to the party.
Wait a minute, Land of the Lost, you didn't like?
Yeah, I know. Weird,
really?
Right? But the one that like I have the argument with all the time about its merits, and not liking it makes me some sort of Philistine, is Donnie Darko. I do not like Donnie Darko.
I'm totally with you, actually.
Oh, okay. Well, it looks like we're split, so... Okay. All right, so...
I also like Donnie Darko.
So Eric and Warren both like it, and Trey and I don't. And I don't know. I don't even really... It's been so long since I've seen it. I think it has a great music video tucked into about the second third of it. And other than that, I think it's just a really boring, half-baked sci-fi movie that doesn't really work. And since it makes its own rules up as it goes, it can get away with a lot of stuff. Because since it doesn't really define the world that it's in, it can kind of just pull stuff out of its ass and be okay. And so for me, I just wasn't impressed with any aspect of it. The visual aspect, the bunny... Just, man, there wasn't really anything to it that I could get into that I really appreciated or walked away from happy with. And I've seen the theatrical and the director's cut, and I've listened to the commentaries and every other, like, bullshit thing that my friends have said. Oh, you've got to, if you haven't seen the director's cut, you're not watching the real version of the movie.
No. So I'm just going to stop you right there before we get off track. In my humble opinion, the commentary... Mm-hmm. And the director's cut ruined the film.
Okay.
Ruined.
Well, I've seen the original theatrical first.
Okay.
No commentary,
yes.
No build up. I had
Absolutely.
It was just shown to me and I watched it.
Yep.
And that was I saw that version three times trying to figure out why people liked it. And then the director's cut came and everyone was like, "He's screening it and he's talking about it and you've got it." And so since I couldn't go to the screenings and listen to him lecture, I watched the movie and then I watched it again with the commentary.
I'm not going to compare Donnie Darko to Tree of Life. But I'm about to use Tree of Life as a metaphor, okay? If Terrence Malick...
It's a giant metaphor?
If Terrence Malick issued a director's commentary where he explained every single plot point in the movie and said, oh, well, because of this, this happened, and because of this, this happened, and what I really meant to say in this was this.
Right.
That movie would suck. Now, whether you like it or not is another thing at this point, okay? For me, the reason I enjoy it is because of my interpretation of it. Donnie Darko is 100% the same way. I think that Richard Kelly is a talented filmmaker who made a movie based on a premise that a lot of people could relate to and then lucked into a really great edit of that film. And that great edit is the first edit, the one that doesn't explain everything, the one that leaves a lot of it up to you. And the reason it works is because the reason that good sci-fi works, and that is because it's about something else. This movie is about a kid who feels alienated. It's about a kid who feels out of place. It's about a high school where the things where the things that he finds are important are not important, and the things that he doesn't find valuable are put up on a pedestal. And in addition to that, the philosophical slant of the school, which is very, very over the top, satirical, featuring Patrick Swayze and this this gym teacher whose name I don't remember the name of the actress, but she's very over the top, and it's almost like a Glee type portrait where they're trying to take this harder edge to a subject that people usually don't assign that kind of an edge to, and that is the high school experience. And because of that, and because of putting in this whole time travel thing, he just finds his way out.
So it's harder edge and unrealistic.
It's just about a kid that finds his way out, man. That's what the whole movie's about. And yeah, there is a cool music video in the middle of it, and there are these cinematic touches.
Yeah.
But the best thing about the movie is that it taps into an emotion that many of us felt in high school, and then it goes in a different direction with that. I think the moment you try to make too much sense out of it, from a plot point of view, that it starts to fall apart.
You can't give a movie a pass on that. You can't. You know, you can't just say,
yes,
like,
you can.
If the plot doesn't work, then you're just watching the movie wrong.
Like, well, that. No, I mean, you can. Like, they're non-plot driven films. Now, I don't think this is trying to be a non-plot driven film.
And if it is, it's not by the accident of the edit, which is what you're giving it credit for in the first place.
Right,
so it's just a dumb
right.
accident.
And that's the thing, is that whatever the edit is, I mean, whatever it's presented as, you have to engage it. You have to engage it that way. But I don't hate this film necessarily, but I don't think it's deserving of the praise that it gets.
Yeah.
I heard one music critic say that why was Dark Side of the Moon one of the best-selling albums of all time always? It's because there are always 15-year-old boys out there that feel alienated and, you know, kind of like
15-year-old boys smoking weed.
Right. I mean, but that's the thing. And that's where I just want somebody to say, I want somebody to go, yeah, Donnie Darko's that.
Lots of weed.
And that's fine. That's fine. But it does not deserve the sort of ridiculous praise.
It is not a
incredibly crafted film. It's not, you know, top to bottom. It's not, you know, incredible.
And I knew people that worshipped it on the same level that, like, I knew a lot of film majors and a lot of film students that worshipped that movie the same way they worship Clerks. You know, same people who didn't think they could make a movie.
And they're just as misguided.
That's just a low blow, sir.
It's true.
Those are rabbit punches. Pun totally intended. Yeah.
So for me, that's kind of how I equate it. I think of people who really thought the idea on paper of being a filmmaker was a really cool idea to say you wanted to be, and then they saw Donnie Darko and thought, well, it can't be that hard. I want to do that.
Essentially what you're talking about is cult classics, and I believe that Clerks is a cult classic, and I believe that Donnie Darko is as well. I'm not going to defend it as being in the cinematic pantheon of some of our favorite movies and some of our most talented directors. I already said before, I feel like Richard Kelly lucked into about half of the draw of this movie because he hit on something that people can relate to. But I do think this is a pretty fantastic film, and what I enjoy about it the most is that it will never be made again by anybody anywhere. And what I mean by that is that a true cult classic is a movie that feels like it came out of nowhere.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And why was this movie was it the early 2000s or the late 90s?
Early
2000s.
Yeah.
Why did this movie from the early 2000s come out about the 80s and have this time travel sci-fi inscrutable element, and then also this whodunit element, right? Because there is a plot twist in the movie.
And then an almost horror element, too, with the bunny.
And I guess what I'm trying to say is that it just hit. It just made sense, and it worked enough. I'm not going to herald it as a cinematic achievement, but I will say that I love movies that stick out that you can't classify anywhere else. And I feel like this is one of those films that just came out of nowhere like a bolt of lightning and was like, what the fuck did we just see?
Yeah. You know I mean? I saw it, I think, in its original release.
Yeah.
So I saw it before a lot of the, like, built-in buzz.
Did you see it in Kansas at the theater when we went to that theater?
Yeah,
we all went to that. Yeah. Ultimate Fake Book. We just got off our tour. We'd heard about this film. We were one of the $500,000 that they made at the box office.
Yeah.
Literally.
Yeah.
This movie didn't even make $1 million. Yeah. At the box office. It was showing for 1 week in Kansas City, and we didn't know what we were going to see, and I really felt like I'd seen something when it was over with.
I mean, it's interesting, but, like, that's the thing, is it's one of those films where I'm, you know, I am just so conflicted because I'm like, yeah, it's okay. You know, if I knew that it earned a couple $1 million and that a couple of, you know, some people liked it and that was fine. But the attention that it garners...
That's why we're having this conversation.
There are so many other films out there
that are better than it.
That do really fascinating, really interesting things.
Right.
I mean, Melancholia could be, in some ways, compared to the same sort of emotional distress.
Except that 15-year-olds who smoke pot can't relate to it.
I understand.
Yeah.
But
well,
they can, it is incredibly crafted.
They'll go for the nude Kirsten Dunst.
But it's still... It still deals with alienation and the seeking a way out and many of the same things.
Yeah.
It even has a sci-fi slant to it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there are lots of similarities. That's a masterwork. And people won't. That will never be a cult classic. And that will never garner the attention that Donnie Darko does. And to me, I think that's worth not liking Donnie Darko.
Yeah. I mean, I'll fully admit, I think that's awesome. Actually, I don't even want to talk over that. That was great. I just want to leave it at that. So I think we should. I think we should all just leave it there.
Indeed.
So
let's just leave because Melancholy is so good, we should not like other films.
Yeah. It's that good that you should just hate every other movie that comes close to. So anyway, we're going to go now. This was a lot of fun.
Lots of fun.
Warren, you should come. You should just come back. You should come back.
You know
You're
what?
Always welcome.
I'm going to talk to my travel agent tomorrow. We're going to make this happen.
You use a travel agent?
No.
All right. Well, on behalf of Trey Hawk, Warren Cantrell, and Eric Moline, we are going to go. Everybody, have a good week, and we'll see you later.
Go Oscars.
Hey, go Oscars.